Reclaiming Christianity, Episode 27, Women and Evangelicalism. Reclaiming Christianity is generously supported by our patrons. Please check us out at patreon.com/John Weldy. Hello again, friends, and welcome back to Reclaiming Christianity, the only Christian podcast where we're pretty sure there's a Bible verse that says, fuck the patriarchy. I'm John Weldy, and I'm just a guy. I am no one of consequence. The whole point of this podcast is to talk back, is to join the community. Would love to have you join the community here. You can check out how to join that community at reclaimingchristianity.net or email me at johnweldy@gmail.com. We would love to have you be a part of this conversation. So I've got a couple guests here this week. We're going to be talking about women in evangelicalism, and this is going to be based out of the book Rescuing Jesus. See, I remember the name of it.
Good job.
The book Rescuing Jesus by Deborah Jean Lee, and we're going to be talking about stories that women have had in evangelicalism and how the church has treated women, and which is a very interesting topic, and sometimes it's a very difficult topic. But let me introduce the panelists to you. First off, we have Tiffany Earle. Tiffany, if you could give us a brief introduction, who are you?
Well, I consider myself a Menzies mythologist, which basically means I teach women how to reclaim their sovereignty through their biological functions of their period.
I feel not worthy right now.
it's basically, there's a lot of shame that surrounds our Menzies myth, especially in Christianity and the curse of Eve. And so, we go through rites of passage and storytelling and anatomy lessons. So it's a really like sex education for, that heals a community kind of thing. So
wow.
I'm also a graduate student studying to be a midwife. So
wow.
That's kind of me in a nutshell.
That's really cool. That's really cool. So we're a book review podcast.
Yes.
We've got people that listen to us that are readers. What's one book that you would recommend to our audience?
But it's two. I'm going to read
two. Yep.
So I've got a nonfiction and a fiction book. The fiction book is called The Power by Naomi Alderman. It is a dystopian future where basically women get this power of shooting electricity through their hands.
Okay.
And it upsets the system and society so much that women gain the upper hand, so to say. And so it's a really fascinating look on how absolute power corrupts absolutely.
And, wow.
It's well done. I really recommended it. It's an amazing book.
Interesting.
The nonfiction book is The Alphabet Versus the Goddess by Leonard Schlein. He's a surgeon who has put forth a hypothesis that through society learning how to read, and particularly Western society and how we read in a linear way, mm-hmm. has made our brain more susceptible to patriarchal society and monotheism. And conversely, through image and through like painting and imagery, you're more susceptible to a matriarchal, egalitarian goddess society. So it's a really fascinating hypothesis that
by the medium, makes a difference.
By the medium.
That's really interesting.
Grows certain parts in your brain to be more susceptible to certain types of thinking. And his, a little spoiler alert, at the very end, he projects that this current state of history that we're in, or this time period that we're in, is that we will become more egalitarian because we are using our computer and texting more.
Yep.
So we're using both sides of both of our, our hands while we're writing. And because we watch more TV and experience more image.
More visual medium.
Yes. With the combination of reading literacy, you will see either a dismantling of both the patriarchy and some just goddess culture. And it will become more of a, I want to say like oneness, but of more Star Trek, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah, that's really cool. So back in the second episode of this podcast, way back about 6 months ago, I did a review on a book and I talked about it that was back when I didn't have guests on the podcast. I was doing it all myself. So I talked about for an hour, this book called Flickering Pixels, How Technology Shapes Our Faith by a guy named Shane Hipps, who worked with Rob Bell at Mars Hill Church. And so he talked about a lot of these same type of things, except his grid was about faith and about how our faith is affected by the technology of, for instance, being read from a scroll, the technology of the printing press and reading, the technology, all sorts of different things. And yes, it's the same type of thing. It's very interesting. Yes. Does your book refer to Marshall McLuhan?
No. Who's that?
Marshall McLuhan is an ad exec from the 60s that his big thing was the media is the message.
Oh, I'm familiar with him. Yes, yes. Okay. But no, it does not refer to that. But yes, it's the whole idea behind propaganda, too. Those who control the story control the world, basically.
So here's a question for you. So what about the media of a man writing about feminine issues? What do you think about that? Because this is that book that you recommended, and it happens all the time.
Right. And so I think he even addresses the irony of using a book to get his point across. I think there can still be significant contributions. They just won't be as poignant, I guess, if you want to say, to a particularly a cis or heteronormative woman, because they see a certain viewpoint. But I don't know. That's a really great question. I haven't really considered that.
Yeah, because this is one thing we talk about. And Jennifer, if you want to jump in on this too, I know I haven't introduced you yet, but this is something we talk about all the time in our book club, because our book club is mostly progressive Christian books. I think it would be great sometime for us to branch outside of Christian books into just some things with, you know, that we see a spin on, and we can put our own spin on it. And that's great, you know. But most of the books that I've done on this podcast, progressive Christian type books, and there's not a lot of female authors. A lot of the stuff that's really popular, I mean, it's by men who are more egalitarian, but still it's by men.
It probably speaks to the cultural, systemic, educational hierarchy and the ability to even study these things. I would say the historical context of that, you know.
I would agree with that. I mean, I find myself every year saying I want to read more books by women, because as I analyzed the books that I've read over the last year, whether that's 75 or 100, which is usually what it is, my percentage is like I'm only reading like 25% women and 75% men. And I would love to see that be more like 50-50. But the stuff that I want to read, I read a lot of theology and C.S. Lewis. And yes, there are women writing about C.S. Lewis, but not as many as there are men. And yes, there are women writing theology, but a lot of the stuff that people are talking about is still stuff that's been written by men, and I want to read that too. So it's difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, when you take the fact that really it's only been in the past 100 years that it's even been acceptable for women to write about theology. Correct. I mean, you have exceptions along the way, you know, like I'll say some names wrong or something, you know, but there's some exceptions among the church fathers, you know, church mothers, you know, but most of them within the past 100 years.
Right.
Okay. So Jennifer, so tell us a little bit about yourself. So we've had you on the podcast several times, but it's been a little while, and there might be people that haven't heard of you before. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I love theology, and so I decided to go to seminary. It might just be a really expensive hobby. I don't know yet, but I do that. I love C.S. Lewis. If you're into the personality stuff, I'm an ENFJ, 514. If you like the Enneagram thing, Ravenclaw, Harry Potter rules. Love fantasy, sci-fi, superhero stuff. That's kind of me in a nutshell.
Cool. So what's one book that you'd recommend?
I can't pick one, man. It's too hard. But I will pick two that are both on the topic.
Man, don't put your patriarchal rules on me.
That's right. The two that I'm picking are both related to the topic that I'm most passionate about tonight, with women's roles in church, basically. So Rachel Held Evans, A Year of Biblical Womanhood, how a liberated woman found herself sitting on her roof, covering her head and calling her husband master. That always cracked me up, the subtitle. And then Jesus Feminist.
I second that too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then Jesus Feminist by Sarah Bessie. So those are my two that I'll go with tonight.
So tell me a little bit, because I'm typing right now, what you just said. Tell me just a little bit about both of those books.
So A Year of Biblical Womanhood, looking at a lot of what the Bible says, kind of like to take things literally about the commands to women, kind of the idea that was it somebody Jacobs, Alan, was it Alan Jacobs?
Yeah, I think it was Jacob something, how to, a year of biblical living.
Yeah, so she's riffing on that idea, but not applying it specifically to this notion of what is biblical womanhood, and then teasing out, okay, well, what really is that? And she gets at, you know, what does it mean to be biblical? We use that word as an adjective, but people mean different things when they say it, and it's, you know, their interpretation and all this stuff. But for me, that book was really, really helpful. When I finished reading that book, actually, I turned to my best friend and I said, I love God more now that I know that he is not restricting me because I'm a woman. He wasn't the one doing that. And that
powerful.
Book was huge for me. It was very powerful.
Yeah, Rachel really writes for like every person also. You know, she doesn't write very complicated stuff. You know, it's really easy to get into what she writes.
Right, right. And then Jesus Feminist. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I just gonna say, what about the Bessie?
Yeah, so Jesus Feminist, it's not really about defending that position so much as saying, look, I love Jesus and I'm a feminist and it works. And like, let's just kind of do this thing. Like, she was like tired of arguing about it. And Sarah just makes me love Jesus more. You can just feel and sense how much she loves Jesus through the writing. It's so powerful. And whereas with other people, it might come off and it might seem cheesy or it might seem fake. With her, when I read her words, when I've gotten the opportunity to meet her in person and hear her speak in person, and she seems just so authentic and down to earth. And I'm like, you know, she's the real deal to, you know, and I look up to her and I respect her so much. And so her words, her books, the two that she's got right now, have both meant a lot to me.
Yeah, that's really cool. I feel that same way when I read Marcus Borg, because when you're in this space deconstructing or progressive Christianity, and it's so easy to read things that are negative, 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 rip this apart, rip this apart. And it's sometimes you really want to read something that's like, okay, so why am I even in this space anymore? Why am I not just an atheist? You know,
yeah.
and Marcus Borg really speaks to me like in the same way that you're talking about, that Sarah Bessie speaks to you.
Mm-hmm.
So the point of this podcast is about women and evangelicalism. We already touched on some really cool issues that can go really deep, really fast. I want to hear stories. I want to hear your stories, and whichever one of you wants to go first, that's fine. And, you know, just jump in. I want to hear your stories about your experiences in evangelicalism.
Okay. I guess I'll go first. I think for myself, I have been so far removed in my journey now from that world. I was raised Nazarene, and in a very missionary focused, family. So it was very subtle, the type of, misogyny and, the patriarchy was so subtle that it was just a norm, because it also mirrored a lot of the culture I was surrounded in. And, I think I really began to internalize a lot of the issues when I got older, and I was like around 22-ish, and I was a little bit more independent. I had gone to Oral Roberts University, very charismatic university, and a lot of the theology there was very surrounded in purity culture as well. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten cancer when I was 23, and I wasn't able to attend church as often. And so in facing my own death in a way, I had to question a lot of what I was taught. And when I finally got well enough to return to church, I was invited to this, to a Bible study where they were doing this series called The World Versus the Church, and the worldview versus God view, basically. And they were showing a clip of the cosmos, Carl Sagan. And he had said, he was talking about how we had descended or we had evolved from star stuff. You know, we were all of this beautiful amalgamation.
Stardust.
Yeah, stardust, exactly. And I just thought it was so beautiful and profound. And the leader said, well, now we know that the Bible says that man and woman, you know, we have a literal creation of 7 days. And I just raised my hand and I said, well, can't it be possible that God used evolution as a vehicle for our, you know, our coming about? And he said, no, we take the Bible literally. And I said, but if that was true, then wouldn't God be both male and female? Because it says God created man and woman in his image, and in his image he created them. And so, and I said, if that were true, then God would be both male and female. And that sounds like intersex. And I don't think that would be agreeable to your consideration of your religion, of what you view God as.
Right.
And what he said next, like, hurt me so bad. That's really started me spiraling. He said, and he looked around the room, it was a small class, and he said, and this is why we don't have women in the church. And so, this is why Paul says women's to remain silent. And I was just so shocked, that even my questioning or my thoughts was so dismissed so easily. I just got up and left. I didn't know what to say. I was, like I said, 23 at the time. And, that kind of, I started reading, Why Christianity Must Change or Die by Sponge, and Sue Monk Kidd's The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, and a lot of Marcus Borg, and it just kind of tumbled from there.
Did you graduate from Oral Roberts?
Yeah, I did. I graduated with a nursing degree. Yeah.
Mm. So at least it wasn't a ministry degree.
No. Yeah. It was practical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good. Wow. I don't know what to say to that.
I didn't either. I was like, this is, so it may be like, has it always been this way? Has the church always been this, harmful to its women when women make up the majority of the church? And so I started unraveling, okay, like back to Eve. I was taught when I got my period, this is because Eve sinned. The original sin of this woman's choice is why you have painful periods and painful labor. And where Adam just, what, he gets to work? Okay, yay.
Yeah.
But my physical being, my original sin is inherent in my blood. And that was really eye-opening as far as maybe how the church viewed me. It was, yeah.
Yeah, it's really how that fundamentalist view of Scripture is. You know, when you take things ultra-literally, then of course you're going to use the Bible to shut down conversation. You know, it's abuse.
It becomes more of a weapon than even a lesson. You know, even if you don't believe the Bible is true, it has some truth in it, and it can be a really beautiful lesson, but it became more of the sword, literally.
Yeah. 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 I mean, if you ignore the genocide stuff, the Bible's really awesome, you know, it's got a lot of great stuff in it. okay. So yeah, that's fantastic. Jennifer, what's your story? How have you experienced evangelicalism?
Similar to, probably, you know, almost every woman who grew up in a conservative evangelical kind of church. My dad was a preacher, so I had that aspect also.
You're the PK.
I'm the PK, you know. No women were allowed to be in ministry. You know, they can be the preacher. We might let them be like a children's director, but we could not. You couldn't call them a minister. You know, that wasn't allowed. And I grew up with this cognitive dissonance between my parents telling me that, yeah, women can do anything that men can do, except for they can't be preachers, because the Bible says so, period. It was like, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. You're telling me that women are equal to men in every way, but we can't do this. And so that would seem to imply that we're not as good, or there's something intrinsic in what it means to be a woman that God says we can't do this or whatever. But, so I always had a problem with that. I think I was probably a feminist before I knew that was allowed. I've experienced a lot of confusion and frustration and grief over the years, because I've always been a strong, independent, intelligent woman with, you know, God-given leadership and teaching abilities. But I was in this environment where women were not supposed to, you know, women can lead women, but they couldn't lead when they couldn't lead everybody, they couldn't lead men. I didn't know. I was reading Rescuing Jesus, and I was reading about there's a Jennifer mentioned in the stories about kind of that focus on women's roles in the church, and she was talking about just how much you internalize when you're raised in that environment, and you internalize things about men leading in the relationship. You internalize the patriarchy, even though you don't even know that word. Like I didn't know what that was. I didn't know that was a thing. And I also went to a conservative Bible college that was the same denomination that I was raised in. But while I was there, I was fortunate enough to have a theology professor who actually challenged some of those more conservative teachings. And the paper I did for his class was on women's roles in the church. And he was actually encouraging me to kind of push back on what really what our denomination taught, which I'm very thankful for that and for him, because I think that really helped me kind of be like, oh, well, if he's, you know, my theology professor at this school and he's questioning this, then maybe I can too.
Yeah.
Without, you know, being a heretic or whatever.
Yeah, it just takes one person, right? Yeah. And I mean, when you're told you can't question, this is the way it is, it just takes one person that you respect to say, yeah, ask questions. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. All right, well, let's move into our book review then. So the book is Rescuing Jesus. Let me see if I can read the, you know, I don't have it in front of me right now.
How People of Color, Women, and Queer Christians Are Reclaiming Evangelism by Deborah Jian Lee.
There you go. That's the subtitle. The subtitles are fun. Every book's got a subtitle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I gave my review on this last week already. I said what I thought about it. Why don't you two ladies, what do you think about this book? What do you like about it? What are the best parts about it?
I kind of read it more like a quantitative study, I guess is the best way to put it, because it's the distinct lives of the different perspectives within the evangelical church and the movement. I found it kind of refreshing, kind of in a way that it says, there's people out there like me or that have experienced a lot what I have experienced. And so, that's kind of the gist of what I got from it.
I would agree with that. It's always helpful to me to read stories of people who had they when they resonate with something, when some part of my experience as well. And then it's also helpful to read perspectives that are outside of my ability to experience, from the people of color and the queer Christians or gay or lesbian Christians which I haven't read those chapters yet. I know that'll be your podcast next week, but but yeah, it's I like the stories that are in there. I like knowing that there's other people out there that are on the same page as me.
Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of great information in it. You know, there's lots of history about how this worked at different times, you know, but yeah, absolutely. The best parts about it are the stories. And there's so many different people she's a journalist, you know, there's so many different people that she talked to and got their stories. It's fantastic. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. The way that I put it last week was, if you are a white cisgender male like me, you must read this book. You really need to read this book. I mean, it'll really open your eyes to a lot of things, you know, but really anybody. It's a great book for anybody to read, even if you're not a progressive type person.
Yeah, I would agree.
All right, so let's get into the book a little bit. Let's read a couple sections. I want to start here, and this is going to be from chapter 2. The way the book is split up is it talks about those three populations. It talks about people of color and women and the LGBTQ community. And it splits up chapters between the three and kind of weaves back and forth between them in here. This is from chapter 2, and I'm going to read a story about Jennifer. And it's not our Jennifer. It's a different Jennifer here. This is called Good Christian Girl. And the way that we do this, panelists, if you want to jump in on me at any point, you know, I mean, I'll pause at certain parts that you can talk during, but if you want to jump in at any point, say, wait, we got to talk about that. Feel free to do that. All right, this is chapter 2, Good Christian Girls, Jennifer. One Sunday morning in the summer of 2008, Jennifer Crumpton, 35, walked into a cavernous megachurch auditorium in Birmingham, Alabama. She sat down among the cascading stadium seats that pointed towards one focal point, a young male pastor with buzz-cut blonde hair and a chiseled jawline, standing on a stage flanked by jumbotrons and washed-in stage lights. Jennifer had come to this Southern Baptist church to learn more about this pastor, David Platt, who at 29 was shaking up the evangelical world. His sermons criticized consumer Christianity and megachurch materialism. He encouraged his mostly white wealthy congregation to pursue downward mobility and to live off what they needed while giving the rest away. This Southern Baptist wunderkind led a congregation of more than 4,000 members, had a New York Times best-selling book, and had practically been anointed as a rising leader of the next evangelical generation. Impressed that Southern Baptist held someone young and anti-materialistic with such esteem, Jennifer began to see Platt as a sign of hope that the staunchly conservative denomination was turning a corner. Sitting in her cushioned seat, she watched the lights train on Platt's youthful figure and eagerly awaited his message. Jennifer had visited Platt's church not only to observe this rising star pastor, but also to hear from God. Up to this point, Jennifer's adult life had taken many abrupt twists and turns. Though an Alabama native, she had left at age 30 to escape the sexism of her Southern Baptist upbringing and to build a new life for herself in New York City. Of course, there she found another variation of misogyny. In Alabama, society prized an unwed woman's virginity and a married woman's homemaking skills. In New York, she met a string of men who valued women for their sexual availability and not much more. For years, Jennifer struggled to unlearn the healthy gender expectations foisted upon her. In the process, she emerged a changed woman. She read feminist books. She left unhealthy relationships. She processed her internalized sexism with her closest friends. By her mid-30s, Jennifer had lost her faith and regained it again. She had gotten married and divorced. As an advertising executive, she had climbed the cutthroat ranks of her industry, but woke up 13 years into her career unhappy with the work and ready for a drastic change. The day she walked into Platt's church, Jennifer's life was already veering in a new direction. She had recently left advertising to enroll in seminary. She had been accepted to Union Theological Seminary in Manhattan, but beyond knowing the basic outline of the curriculum, she had no idea what to expect of this experience and what it meant for her future. Before school began, she pulled herself from the throbbing crowds of Manhattan for a brief respite in her hometown, a suburb of Birmingham. She wanted to relax with family and old friends and take in the familiar sights of the wide bending streets and canopies of dogwood trees. Here, she would reflect on her seminary goals and listen for God's guidance on her future. Where would seminary take her? To a pulpit of her own as a church pastor? To become head of a Christian nonprofit? Would she forge a ministry of her own? She envisioned herself doing something rewarding and profoundly meaningful. The possibilities excited her. During the service at Platt's megachurch, Jennifer listened to the thousands of voices lifted in worship and sang along. She looked around at the audience. They were young and old, men and women dressed impeccably in their business casual attire. When Platt began speaking, she straightened in her seat. She had been waiting for this moment. Would God speak to her through Platt? Standing at the podium, Platt told his listeners that the church was nominating deacons and elders that day. Jennifer expected this to be a brief announcement before he moved on to the meatier parts of the service. Instead, Platt began sermonizing about why women could not be nominated to these positions.
So let me ask a question. Why do you think women are so threatening to leadership? In that they can't step into that. Where does that come from?
So me answering as the resident white guy, I'm going to say, so we all have our struggles. We all want something more, and we all want church to be a certain thing in a certain way. And the way church is built, it's built as a top-down pyramid power structure and
hierarchy.
Yes, a hierarchy. And if you're serious about it, you want to climb that hierarchy because that's what we've made it. You know, we've made it like the corporate ladder. you know, and you want to climb that hierarchy. And that's the only way that it works, because we set it up so that one person talks to 300 or 500 or 4,000 people at a time. One person. We've set it up in that way, you know, or maybe there's a worship band that has five or six people playing for 300 or 500 or 10,000, you know, it's just a few people doing the work while however many other people watch. And so if you're serious about it, the message is you've got to get in there and you've got to be one of those important people. But it's not me being important. It's that I want to do this for God. Me right. As the white male, I tried for decades to climb that power structure and kept hitting every single door after door. I did all the right things. I said all the right things. I learned all the right things. And I kept having door after door after door slammed in my face. I had multiple churches that I spoke at one church service. I finally got to be the guy, and then never again. And this is to your point. If that's what I'm experiencing as the white male, the cisgender white male that we're striving for, of course it's going to be worse for somebody. If there's something in the Bible that you can twist to take it to your advantage, that's what you're going to do, because that's what you're looking for. That's the structure that we've set up.
Well, and if we go back to what we were saying prior to even the podcast about the storytellers get to control the world, if the majority of your storytellers are male seeking power, the majority of the stories are always, I'm thinking of even in mythology, when a woman escapes from her place or doesn't know her place or doesn't conform to the role of a woman, there consequences happen. I mean, there's a lot of fairy tales about that, or even, I'm thinking of like the tale of Lilith in Jewish mythology, where she became too much of a leader in her own right, or a strong-willed woman, and they turned her into a demon. So I just wonder if it's more so wanting to, they don't want to share power. Is that the idea, or?
It's systemic, I think. I truly believe that most people in any church, most people in evangelicalism really want to do the right thing, really want to serve God, really want to be good people. But it's just the way the system's set up. It doesn't work that way. It's set up for a power structure.
Well, and I see a parallel to, you know, the people who are in power, they like the way it is, right? They don't see a need to change. They don't want to change. It's serving them. They like their place in that world. So where is their motivation to dig deeper and to look at historical context and to say, oh, maybe that wasn't a prescription for all women in all time. Maybe that was a localized situation. And hey, maybe Paul also had some of the cultural attitudes towards women because of where he was in history and his place in time. And, you know, do you all see a parallel between when we talk about things like white privilege and that systemic issue? I see kind of a parallel there between that and between issues of patriarchy and, you know, I don't know.
Oh yeah. It's also intersectional altogether. I totally agree that the people in power wish to remain in power, and you're right. They don't have any incentive to share, basically.
Right.
Well, and we're so married to capitalism.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, capitalism has invaded the church, you know, because really the church in America drives the world church in many different ways. You know, at least right. We think that we do, you know, and capitalism has so, and that power has so gotten into our churches, you know, and we know that the way capitalism works, there's never enough. There's never enough. I mean, who was the millionaire in the 19th century that they asked him, you know, how much is enough? You know, J. Paul Getty or one of these guys, how much is enough? Oh, just a little bit more. Yeah, just a little bit. There's always, and so wherever you're at in the system, you feel like you need to get further. Even if you're at the tip top, you feel like you need to get further.
I guess coming from another viewpoint though, is I don't know if this is sustainable, because just even in our environment, it's interesting. I one of the things I teach on is the treatment of women paralleling the treatment of Earth, the raping of our women as the raping of the Earth, taking what you think belongs to you.
Yeah.
Whether that's a woman's own autonomy and rights, and how we also treat the Earth that way. I think we're paying the price for it very soon, and until we learn to share, honestly. And yeah. I don't know. I'm pretty nihilistic. I don't know if we've passed that point where we can recover.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Really good question. I think that just needs to hang out there. Let's get back into the text. I'm going to pick up a few sentences before I left off. Standing at the podium, so this is when Platt finally comes up. Standing at the podium, Platt told his listeners that the church was nominating deacons and elders that day. Jennifer expected this to be a brief announcement before he moved on to the meatier parts of the service. Instead, Platt began sermonizing about why women could not be nominated to these positions. He cited Bible verses from 1 Timothy 3:1-13, which details the qualifications required for church overseers and deacons. An example of the text: a deacon must be faithful to his wife and must manage his children and his household well. Platt argued that based on the pronouns used and the social position of women in biblical times, God barred women from leadership. Jennifer listened, waiting for the punchline, but none came. Is he serious? She thought. And then a strange series of emotions tumbled like dominoes inside of her. First amusement, then confusion, then shock and discouragement, followed by so many questions. Platt's message plunged Jennifer back into the patriarchal Southern Baptist world of her youth. She had spent her whole life trying to unlearn the message that women ranked lower than men in intellect, value, and leadership abilities. She had hoped that her generational leaders, leaders like Platt, were slowly upending those traditional ideas and expanding the church's vision of who belonged in leadership. Jennifer had gone to Platt's church hoping to hear from God, hoping to be filled with inspiration as she began seminary training to become a faith leader herself. Instead, Platt's message served a devastating blow. It reinforced all the invalidating sexist messages she had worked to silence. For a moment, she wondered, was there anything for her on the other side of seminary? If women weren't allowed to lead, how could she find a place to use her talents and fulfill her dreams? For one long moment, Jennifer had no answers to her questions. She did not know that very soon she would find the answers on her own. She did not know that in a few short years, she would forge an entire ministry around those answers. She did not know that her ministry would add momentum to the growing push for gender equality in the church. She did not know, because in that moment, with the weight of Platt's words on her shoulders, the entrenched sexist values of her past threatened to overpower her.
Can I just say, I see so much of my own experience in this Jennifer's story.
I was hoping you would say that.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, I mean, that sentence, she had spent her whole life trying to unlearn the message that women ranked lower than men in intellect, value, and leadership abilities. And the thing is, people went out of their way to say, no, women are equal to men and all of this stuff. But that's not what they really taught, because they limited what women could do. They said, no, women can't teach men. Women can't lead men. And they said it's because God says so. They said it's because the Bible says so. And they believed it. And yeah. So I have empathy for them. But at the same time, I say, this is bullshit. And it makes me angry. It really yeah. makes me angry, because I feel like there are so many women who have it so much worse than I do, who get trapped in relationships, in a marriage that may turn abusive. There's all kinds of statistics on how patriarchy, fuels the, at the very least, the ability for abusers to maintain control. And, you know, and we have all these stories about how the church covers up abuse and tell women to stay with their abuser. And that's a whole other tangent. But like, my point is, patriarchy is evil, and it is still embedded in conservative evangelicalism for the most part. And I'm sick and tired of it, and I want to burn it down.
Yeah. Yeah. She says later on, I think it's Jennifer, this person we're talking about here, she says later on, "I believe with every bone in my body that patriarchy is a result of sin."
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk about that, right? We don't talk. Right. I mean, we talk about this happened because of the fall. This happened because of the fall. And I've heard people talk about how Adam, you will have rule over her, you know, talking about having rule over Eve. And I've heard pastors before say, oh, well, this is the structure that was supposed to be set up. No, this is a result of the fall. This is according to your book. It's because of the fall that the man has dominion over the woman. It doesn't mean it's a good thing.
Right.
This is the result of a fallen world. So why shouldn't we put that back in the right place? Are we just going to resign? Oh, this is how it is. So I guess we just leave it. Like, bullshit. No, no, you don't just leave it like that. You fix it. There's so much good stuff. There's so much good stuff that we get into that they have a study that's in this book that's in around the 200s back in one of the later chapters that talks about it's a study about women in power, women in leadership positions, either CEOs or board members of nonprofits. And it contrasts women in evangelical nonprofits with women in the greater nonprofit world. And I've got the link to this study in the show notes. And it's a really fascinating study to go into. And the analysis of this study, I'm going to read word for word the analysis of this study that Deborah writes into her book. Women account for only 19% of top paid evangelical leaders, 21% of board positions, and 16% of CEOs. These figures significantly trail the larger nonprofit world, where women make up 48% of board membership and 40% of CEOs. In evangelical organizations, 21% of board positions. In the greater nonprofit world, 48% of board positions, pretty much equal. In the evangelical world, CEOs, 16% of CEOs in the evangelical world are women. In the greater nonprofit world, 40% of CEOs are women.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
So far behind.
So I bring it back to, is it they're not aware of how far behind they are? Are they intentionally pushing people out? Statistical disparity, like the difference between them, is so great.
It's intentional.
It's what she's talking about
with David Platt.
It has to be.
So here's something that really encourages me. Just recently, Bill Hybels from Willow Creek Church, one of the premier mega churches in the United States, around Chicago, Illinois. They went on like a 2-year study to find out who his successor was going to be. And they ended up picking two successors, and one of them is a woman.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge step. I mean, I would love to see, I think it's great that they want to do, I mean, it's why are we still talking about this? I mean, it's freaking ridiculous that we're here in 2018 and we're still talking about, oh, should women be able to preach? Oh, should women be able? Come on!
I know, it's absurd, and it's what I was telling you before we started recording tonight about. I was reading in one of the later chapters where it was talking about how there had been all of these strides for there was something going on in politics with a push for equality and for women, and then there's all this pushback that comes in the 80s. Which is where John Piper and Wayne Grudem and their recovering biblical manhood and womanhood, and so they revert, they get scared because evangelical feminists had been gaining ground, and they're like, oh no, we can't have that. That's not right. That's not biblical. And they come in, and so then in the '80s, there's this big pushback the other way, and you see that play out in the Southern Baptist Seminary here in Louisville. They like it had gotten more liberal or whatever, and then they got a new president and kind of got rid of all of the more liberal people and then put in all of these like conservative, complementarian Calvinist people. And so I was just getting mad reading about it, because I'm like, they were making progress, and then these idiots have to come in and make it go backwards again.
Okay, so I have a question to that too, which is, I have noticed that women are complicit a lot of times in our own subjugation, in that we uphold a lot of this patriarchal structure as well. And is that a survival mechanism? I'm just kind of wondering. When I lived in Egypt, I worked with women who, it was about 70% of women are circumcised. And so I was working in a grassroots movement to try to address the issue of circumcision, particularly with women. And it was always, the men would say, for the most part, it's up to my wife if she wants to circumcise our daughter or not. And the women would always say, we are circumcising our daughters. And it would blow my mind. And the only reasoning I could get to it would be that when you don't make it safe, okay, they value, let me back up a little bit. They value virginity so much that if you don't bleed on your wedding night, grounds for divorce, grounds for killing. I mean, like it is intense. And so a lot of times circumcision practices allow for that to be more of a guarantee, just because of the trauma that's endured by the woman. And so I think, at least what I could wrap my head around is that the mother, if the girl did not bleed on her wedding night, it would reflect poorly on the mother, and the mother would also face the shame as well. So this was one way of the mother protecting her daughter from the potential shame in the future. And so they were very, it was hard to address. And so I see a lot of parallels here. How are the women complicit in our own, is it a survival? I guess is what I'm just trying to say.
I think sometimes it's survival. I think sometimes it goes back to, okay, I'm in this environment, I'm in this system, and I think I've been told my whole life, this is what God says, and this is what the Bible says, period. And there's no, you can't question that. If you question that, you're questioning God, and you're not allowed to question God. And so if you were in that system, if that is where you're at in your beliefs, it is very, very difficult to push back without,
it doesn't match up with the cognitive bias, basically.
Right. Yeah, you're right.
That happens from
plus
it.
Plus there's fear, I think, that your Christianity will be questioned, that your faith will be questioned, you're being belligerent and you're not obeying God and you're, you know, all of this stuff. So there's a lot, I think there's a whole lot of, just complication and baggage. Well, and
even
stuff.
As you say that, I'm thinking of the labels that were thrown on women that I knew of Jezebel spirit. That is a big one that is thrown around in the church whenever a woman comes into her own and questions authority is, oh, we need to pray that Jezebel spirit out of her.
I mean, people would kind of joke about that in my circles. It wasn't taken so seriously as it is maybe in more of the, I feel like that might go along with a more charismatic
denomination.
Most definitely.
It's big there.
And so in my circles, we weren't the charismatic group, so we kind of joked about it. But underlying the joking was still the same theology, you know, that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So you touched on here and also earlier, you touched on purity culture. We've got some time left, not a ton, a lot of time. I know that this is something that we could talk about for literally an entire episode and multiple episodes about purity culture. But I'm wondering if we should just touch on this a little bit here. I'm not going to read a section on purity culture. I'm going to read a few quotes from the book, and I just want you to comment on that, what you get from them. So one of them, this is from page 55. There were two important rules for women, and they seemed to be contradictory. One, that responsibility rested with the woman in guarding her virginity and stopping boys from escalating intimacy. This is talking about teenagers. And two, that the woman should submit to the man and the relationship.
That, the first part of that quote really made me have a lot of flashbacks into my own childhood and my teen years in particular, because of some sexual harassment I had experienced in the church and outside the church, and the internalized shame that a woman swallows because of that is profound, because you start to question, what was I wearing? What was I doing that invited that? It must be inherent in who I am that gets this unwanted attention. You aren't taught proper boundaries in the church. That's one thing I will always complain. You don't have it. You are not affirmed in your autonomy and boundaries. And so when you are approached, or not even approached, but harassed in such a way, it can be degrading. And instead of questioning the abuser, the victim takes on the mantle of shame, and I must have done something wrong. I'll need to change the way I talk. I need to change the way I walk. I need to change the way I dress so that this assault doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that we realize we as a evangelical culture, I mean, I grew up in this also, you know, I grew up in a very fundamentalist Baptist church, you know, and I got all this stuff, although I was a really awkward kid. You know, I never had girlfriend. So I didn't need to be hearing all this stuff, you know, but, all this, we put so much weight on the girl, you know, these two contradictory things. Number one, it's your job. Don't wear something that the boys are going to, because the boys can't control themselves, obviously, you know, and the other thing is that you need to submit to the man. I mean,
right. And part of that is submitting your own virginity, your thoughts, your finances. It's quite depressing.
I've heard people, friends of mine, talk about, you know, well, when do we have to start, not falling under his leadership? Do we do that when we're engaged, or does that not start until we're married? And like, say, you know, the purity culture thing, you know, I've never really dated, so it hasn't maybe impacted me as directly as it has so many other people, but I sure have read a lot of stories of other people, and I have witnessed things like the woman being kicked out of Bible college because she gets pregnant, but the boyfriend is allowed to stay and stay on the soccer team. There's garbage like that where somehow the woman is punished and the man is not punished when they both had sex before marriage, but for some reason it's only the woman's fault. Yeah. She's the only one who receives punishment. And, another thing I read about purity culture in this book, Rescuing Jesus, was talking about the was it the purity ring or the, what do they call it? The ring.
Yeah, the purity rings, promise rings.
Yeah, promise rings, I guess, or purity rings. I don't know. Yeah. I never had one myself, but again, it was a popular thing when I was growing up in youth group and stuff. But I didn't get then what is attached to it is like that the woman is under her father's, you know, domain and she has to obey him until the point when she gets married. And then that transfers the ownership for all intents and purposes to the husband. And again, they wouldn't say that. They wouldn't say it's about ownership. But it is, I think, about control.
Yeah. It's the picture. Actually, I've got a quote from that, from the book right here. Let me read this quick. Fathers, this is from page 116. Fathers bought their daughters, but not their sons, purity rings, which the young women wore on their left ring finger as a symbol of their virginity, only to be removed when replaced by a wedding ring. It symbolized the patriarchal idea that a woman transfers her guardianship from one man to the other. The fact that men didn't have purity rings underscored the gravity of a woman losing her virginity before marriage. She's damaged goods. Compared to the redeemable act of a man doing the exact same thing, he merely stumbled. It's a system where women's bodies are controlled and their voices are silenced and men hold the authority.
Yeah, that's the part I highlighted.
And I wonder if it maybe goes back to even further when a woman's pregnant, for a lot of history, you couldn't tell who got her pregnant if she slept around. And so I wonder if it has to do more with no man wants to raise another woman's progeny kind of thing, yeah, or another man's, you know, it's kind of, I know that sounds really crass, but I think a lot of purity culture is seeped in inheritance and things of that nature.
Yeah. So yeah, we could go on and on that. There's so much in here, and this is probably something. This would be something great to do a whole episode on later on. I just wanted to make sure that we didn't end this talk without at least touching on this. I don't want to. It's so easy to end on a low note. It's so easy to go, oh man, this needs to change. This needs to change. This needs to change. I want to try to kind of end on a high note here, and I want to ask you two a question. Do you think evangelicalism can be reclaimed?
No.
Why not?
Because when you don't have representation, okay, this is a great quote I read. It said, when you only see God as man, man becomes God. And so until you can even address that women in our Western culture don't even have a divine feminine, and maybe Mary is the closest that we have, there will not be an equal representation within the evangelical community. And so I take the stance of, oh, the goddess Kali and Sekhmet, and in their mythology, they believe that when something didn't serve or when something got too big, they just destroyed it all. And then the new life grew from that. And so I'm very much a burn it all down.
Yeah. That's my, I mean, I talked about this some last week, you know, but that's my idea too. I mean, my podcast is obviously called Reclaiming Christianity. I think Christianity can and needs to be reclaimed. I don't think evangelicalism can be. I think it's political.
As we know it now, no. Yeah.
I think it's completely political. Leave it to the politicians.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm inclined to agree with both of you. I have some friends who are Christians who are egalitarian and you know, I guess I would agree with more of their theology, and they, you know, they don't agree with the alignment of politics with evangelicalism, and they want to reclaim evangelicalism. I'm not sure that's really possible. I feel like it's been too far compromised by the political garbage, and I feel like for the most part it is too entrenched in patriarchy and all of that stuff. So I guess I'm very skeptical of that word at least being able to be reclaimed. But
yeah,
like John, I'm all about reclaiming Christianity.
So if we can't reclaim evangelicalism, how can we address these problems? What are other ways we can address these problems that we've been talking about?
I think I read where you, a quote, reading, it's from the book, reading was the first step in deprogramming from evangelicalism. From
That's so good.
From all that. And that is my story. I remember reading a blog from Brian Zond a few years ago where he talked about how he had read himself into a completely new and much richer place theologically. And that's me. I feel like I've done that same exact thing over the last several years. It's how I have gotten to wherever I'm at now on my journey. And I feel like that's huge for people if they're willing to read anything outside of, you know, their key, you know, whoever it is, if all they ever read is Piper, that's not going to help. But if they're willing to maybe read a book by Sarah Bessie or Rachel Held Evans, or, you know, if they're willing to read from other perspectives and see that there's other options out there, I feel like that is a way to address the problem. And it's part of why I intend to write even more than I have so far on my own blog and through Twitter and Facebook and whatever about, you know, kind of where I've landed on some of these things, because I feel like that's what helped me was reading other blogs and things that led me to other books. And so if I can be that person for somebody else, I want to be.
Yeah.
I would say, I feel like you can dismantle this type of culture. When a it's particularly for women, I'm really going to address them, is that when you realize your own inherent worth outside of the male culture gaze, when a woman comes into her own autonomy and boundaries, if you can learn that, and if we can even teach that within the church and outside the church, you no longer take part in that subjugation anymore, and we're no longer taking part in being tamed, honestly.
So in evangelicalism, in Christian fundamentalism, in most of Christianity, we have completely lost the divine feminine.
Correct. Yeah.
So how do we reclaim the divine feminine?
Using the personal pronouns it would be a start. Addressing God as goddess. I mean, that makes people really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Just to even hear that, like, oh, but that's idolizing, you know, because we even in the Bible, they talk about, you know, the goddess and those were the idols. Those were the other people who believed in that. But if our place can be represented, if God is just a non-entity, I guess, or a divinity, we need to recognize that God is us. We are part of that divine inheritance.
We are in God as fish are in water.
Yes, exactly.
It's been huge for me to think that God is not man. God is not male. God does not have a penis. And that sounds crass, but it's true. And so it's helpful for me to think and to switch up the pronouns and try not to just say he all the time for God, but maybe to also refer to God as she, or just refuse to use a he or she sometimes. If it's he or nothing, you know, and just plug in God or God's self, you know, I'd rather do that. But I also like playing with the pronouns and going back and forth between he and she, because God is not a man. God is not a woman. Yeah. God, you know, and to put God in that box is limiting. And so it is, and it's helpful when I've read where people have switched out the pronouns in certain worship songs or hymns or things. That's helpful for me.
Hmm.
So if that's okay, can I bless this community with the Psalms 23 with the changing of the pronouns?
Please.
Okay. So I'll go ahead and read it. The divine is my shepherd. I have all I need. She makes me lie down in the green meadows. Beside the still waters, she will lead. She restores my soul. She rights my wrongs. She leads me to the path of good things and fills my heart with song. Even though I walk through a dark and dreary land, there is nothing that can shake me, for she has said she won't forsake me, and I am in her hand. She sets a table before me in the presence of my foes and anoints my head with oil, and my cup overflows. And surely, surely the goodness and kindness will follow me all the days of my life, and I will live in her house forever and ever. Glory be to the mother and the daughters and the holies of the holies, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
Amen.
Oh. There's a really great YouTube, and I can send you the link, but there's a really great YouTube video of this in song form. And I just weep every time I hear it, because I recognize God is me. Like, I have a place in God.
Yeah.
And that's really hard for someone who has lost their Christianity, but to know that there's a divine place that I have in this world.
So this is what went through me when you were reading that. I grew up with divorced parents, you know, like most people do, you know, like a whole lot of people do, Christian or not. And I live with my dad. I was one of those few that the father has custody, because there were three of us boys, you know, and my mother had some issues, you know, so the court awarded custody to my father. So I grew up in an all male household for most of my life. And I don't want to speak ill of my mother, you know, but she was never the perfect mother. She was never that, you know, June Cleaver.
Yeah, the mother wound is a whole nother thing you could get into there too.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I loved my mother, you know, but I always felt like I was missing something. And that's what I really felt. You know, I mean, when you get this picture of God as father, you know, I've got this picture of who my father was, a very clear picture of who my father was. good and bad, both together, you know, but thinking of the divine feminine, thinking of the divine as that mother, you know, I mean, I closed my eyes and I felt myself invited into this home. I have an aunt, Aunt Elaine, who was a mother to me. She really was. She had a house full of girls, and it was a completely different experience when I went over to her house. She's still fundamentalist, you know, but I love her so much to this day just because of that warm, inviting atmosphere she created. And that's what I got. I've never felt that from a father God, the picture of a father God before. But right. Thinking about a mother God, that's the kind of feeling that you can have.
We are missing the nurturance that the female presence brings, the safety and the loving and the, and not that fathers can't be loving, but for the most part, the patriarchy has determined that father means protector, means warrior, means provider. But we are missing the nurturance, the empathetic voice of God.
Yeah, that's so good.
I would just add to that there's another resource that has helped me a lot. It's called God Our Mother. It's from the liturgist, and you can find it on Spotify. And there's a little meditation on that, and there's a song that reflects on God Our Mother, and it's amazing.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a great episode. Yeah, it seems like we talk about, hey, you guys need to listen to the liturgist like every three episodes of this podcast at least.
It's true though.
Yeah, it's so good. They've got so much good stuff. So I can't think of any better way to end this. That was absolutely beautiful, Tiffany. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
So I'm going to say goodbye to the two of you. Thank you so much. This was wonderful discussion. Tiffany, where can people find you if they want to connect with you?
Well, I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma, so you can physically try to find me. Please don't come to the hospital. That means you're sick. But other than that, I mean, you can try to add me on Facebook. I'm Tiffany Earle, but I prefer if you do try to add me on Facebook, send me a little message, just how you know me or where you heard me from.
Awesome. And you said that you teach?
Yeah. So I do teach empowering women's classes. We meet in a bookstore, and I'm one of the co-leaders, and we just address, it's mainly just for women, and we're starting to hold ceremonies for first periods for younger girls to have a better experience than maybe my generation had.
A rite of passage.
Exactly.
Okay. That's beautiful. Jennifer, where can people find you?
People can find me on my blog, JenniferNeihart.com, and that my last name is NEYHART, and it's the same thing on Twitter, Jennifer Neihart, Instagram, Facebook, look me up, and I'd love to connect with you.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you both for being a part of this conversation. It's been wonderful.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
All right. So let me wrap up here. So the next episode, if you all love that, there's one more episode on this book, Rescuing Jesus. Last episode, if you loved what you just heard about women in evangelicalism and how it's been and what we can do to make positive changes, the previous episode was about people of color in evangelicalism. Next episode is going to be about the LGBTQ community in evangelicalism. And I encourage you to listen to all three of these episodes. I encourage you also to check out the book, Rescuing Jesus. Deborah Jean Lee is the name of the author. So the next episodes after this, in our book club, if you want to join the book club, we study these books together for a whole month. And we have a Facebook group that we talk about them. Would love for you to be a part of that. If you want to find out how to get onto that group, it's a secret group. So you're not going to be able to find it just by looking up the title of the group. The reason why we do that is because there's some people in the group that aren't necessarily out as a progressive Christian, you know, or they're not necessarily in a safe place. Like they still think their family still thinks they're a Republican. Not saying that if you join the book club, you can't be a Republican, you know, but you might not have much fun. But we want to make it a safe place for anybody, you know, even Republicans. So that's okay. if you want to be a part of this book club and study these books along with us and have a voice, be a part of the community, we'd love for you to do that. Check out my website at reclaimingchristianity.net and click on book club. It shows you how to be a part of that, how to send a request, and we'll get you in the book club there. The upcoming books that we have in the book of in the month of March, we're going to be talking about Finding God in the Waves by Mike McHarg, Science Mike. It's going to be great. We've got those episodes all planned out. It's going to be fantastic. In April, we're going to be talking about The Bible Tells Me So by Pete Enns. And in May, Why I Left, Why I Stayed by Tony and Bart Campolo. We have a couple other projects that are going to be starting also that are really, really exciting. I think it's in April, we're going to be starting a 6-month project. It's going to be just one episode a month, but it's going to be a 6-month project that's going to be a survey of the New Testament through Marcus Borg's Evolution of the Word. And so Marcus Borg puts this, it puts the New Testament in chronological order. And, you know, it's debatable, you know, but it's his version of chronological order. And he talks about how the New Testament evolved along the way and change, you know, and it's a very, very interesting thing to look at. And I'm really excited to study that with you over the course of 6 months. There's also something else that I'm really excited to do. And I'm just going to talk about this briefly. A friend of mine started a science fiction and theology book club, which is really cool for those few people. Some of you out here is going to, okay, you checked out by now and that's okay. But we're going to be doing the same type of a thing, a 6-month, about one time a month discussion, a 6-month watch through of the show Battlestar Galactica. If you know this show, it's got a lot of interesting theology in it. It's got polytheism and monotheism and all sorts of different spiritualities baked into the show in a crisis atmosphere. And it's going to be a really cool time. It's something that honestly, me as a sci-fi geek, I've been waiting to do for about 10 years since the show aired. And I'm really excited about it. And some of you guys don't care about it at all. And that's okay. But it's not going to be in place of the podcast. It's going to be like bonus episodes of the podcast. So if you don't care about it, just skip to the next one. And that's going to be perfectly fine. If it's something that you're geeking out about, then would love for you to be a part of that also. Just send me a message at reclaimingchristianity.net. So one last thing that I'd like to say to friends, it's the same thing I say to you every week. The most beautiful thing you can ever be is you. Do what you love. Love what you do. Thanks for listening.